When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Hello and welcome to the How To Academy podcast, the bi-weekly show from London's home of big thinking. I'm Vas Christodoulou. Dr. Richard Restak is one of America's leading neurologists and works as a professor at George Washington University in his 80s. You might have heard him before on this podcast, where he shared the secrets of developing and preserving your memory. He returned to How To Academy a few weeks back to share what science can tell us about delaying and preventing the onset of dementia. It's the subject of his new book, fittingly called How to Prevent Dementia, an expert's guide to long-term brain health. Here he is in conversation with Hannah McInnes.
So you say at the start of your book in your introduction that there are, I think it's three core beliefs that underline the structure of this book. I was just wondering if you could explain what the core beliefs are that run through it.
Well, one of the core beliefs is that the more you know about dementia, the better you're going to do about both in preventing yourself from getting it and also how to handle people who don't have it, or rather who fall and have this. The other thing is sort of a personal important thing to me is the fact that we're talking about a disturbance in thinking. And that means that there's not such a much division between psychiatry and neurology. It's disturbed thinking. Memory, for instance, is the most common thing that's noted with Alzheimer's, where people begin to lose memory. But losing memory is not necessarily a sign of a neurologic disease. It can be normal. Memory is seen in people with depression, for instance, which is thought to be psychiatric. So that's the second thing that I like to do. And the third thing is the continuum, as I have it, between normal thought and any of these dementias. Practically nothing that you see in dementia is something that can't be seen in normal thinking. We all forget things. We all get a little suspicious of people. We all have our irritability days. We all have our days where we're not quite ourselves. All these kinds of things, of course, exaggerated and made worse in people who were coming down with mild cognitive impairment and dementia. So these are the three things that I want to emphasize.
Who are you talking to? Who's the book for? Who is your audience that do you think? Is it for everybody? Is it for people over a certain age?
It's for everyone. It's for any adult. I wouldn't think it would be too much interest to children or to adolescents, or even very young adults, but it's anyone, because everybody now in this culture is worried about Alzheimer's, the big A. You're hearing about it, reading about it, seeing it in television, seeing it in movies, streamed Netflix things. I mean, they're all people worried about coming down with dementia. So what is dementia and how can you prevent it? What steps can you take to make it less likely? And it's an important point to emphasize. And we're not talking about guarantees. You know, life doesn't have any guarantees. I mean, you could be doing all the exercising and all the mental exercising, but if you step out in front of a car and, you know, when you're hit down, you could be killed. So life doesn't involve guarantees. What you do is take certain steps which increase or decrease the odds of you coming down with dementia in this case.
Which I want to go into in detail, as you do in the book, and I'm sure that people will be fascinated to hear these pieces, these very good bits of advice that you have. But first of all, you said everybody's worrying about it now. Is it because it's more prevalent now? You give us some statistics in the book that you say are a cause for pessimism or optimism, depending on which one of those things you naturally are.
Yeah, of course. And bear in mind that the lifespan now is much higher than it's ever been in history, really. If you go back just 100 years, the lifespan was in the 40s and early 50s. So the chances of Alzheimer's developing in that age group is very low. So now when it's more prevalent than before, predominantly in people 60, 70 and older, then you can say, well, it's not necessarily a sign that it's more frequent or that it's more common within a population. It's just as the population ages, you're going to see more of it because it's a late onset disease, usually.
Well, one of the things that is undeniably a cause for optimism is your statement that you think this book is just a holding book, because you say you think, I believe you write, a remedy will be available in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yes, exactly. And the other thing to bear in mind is maybe we're not, or we shouldn't be talking about a cure. For instance, most of the Alzheimer's that comes on in the 80s, so that in fact up to 40% of people 80 years of age or older have some evidence of early Alzheimer's. Suppose you can develop a medication that holds that off for just 5 years. That would be a major triumph, because then people would be living for the last 5 years of their life clear of Alzheimer's. So that we don't think of it as a cure, or perhaps the goal of finding a cure for it is too ambitious. We don't have a cure for diabetes. We don't have a cure for hypertension. We may not have a cure, or we shouldn't be holding ourselves to the strict requirement that we come up with a cure for it. If a drug is developed, which delays its onset, then that's a major victory.
You talked about longevity being one of the main reasons that it's more prevalent. But is that the main reason that you say it's more, the risk is higher in more economically secure countries?
No one's certain about why that is. First of all, the age and longevity is longer because there's better health care. The other thing is that the other health in better developed or greater developed countries, the air is purer in general. They eat better diets in general. So all these various things would seem to be protective of Alzheimer's, but they're not, for reasons that we're not totally sure about. But all I said, living longer does increase the odds, and you do live longer in an area where you're in a civilization is more developed.
So the title is How to Prevent Dementia. And I think a lot of people's immediate reaction will be, is it preventable? You've touched on this. You've said, you know, you can't predict anything particularly. You could do all the right things and you don't know what will happen. But surely in many cases, it is inevitable and all the steps you could take wouldn't ward it off.
Well, there are certain versions of it that are hereditary. Those are ones that come on at younger ages. That is a highly hereditable condition and is of some concern. We don't know to the extent we can delay that, but most cases, the greater majority, the lion's share of the cases come on later for unknown reasons. And that's an important thing to emphasize. We really don't know the cause of the cases of dementia, with the exception of ones like vascular dementia, which means the blood vessels have gotten aged. We know the plaques and tangles and things like that of Alzheimer's are present, but are they the cause of the disease? That's a major, major question, because there's a lot of indication to show that there are other possible causes, just simply inflammation may be the cause. I mentioned in the book, inflammation, if prolonged, would cause the development of plaques and tangles. So we're really at a situation where we're not really certain of the cause. And it's hard to treat an illness or to find an illness approach when we're not sure of the cause of it. There's been a lot of investment in terms of actual financial investment in terms of drug companies and investors in the deal that it's due to amyloid and tau, these two accumulations of abnormal brain products. But, you know, these may be just simply side effects of a more fundamental process that then produces these taus and tangles. So there's a political aspect to the treatments they're developing. There's a lot of investment of time and money and things like that into development of drugs that are aimed at to amyloid. And a lot of people don't think amyloid is the basic cause of it. But because we don't know what the cause is, we can't disprove necessarily that amyloid is, as of now, amyloid is the one that is the basis for all of the treatments that are coming up. The different drugs in the last year or two are all anti-amyloid, and they are showing some improvement, but they have a lot of side effects, these drugs. So they have to be followed carefully by the doctors because a person could have strokes and things like this. So it's far from an ideal situation, drug treatment-wise.
One of the things that's really important to do before we go on is, of course, to clarify, as you do, the difference between dementia. You talk all the way through the book about Alzheimer's and dementias. Could you explain?
Yeah, the umbrella term is dementia. That means, you know, it used to mean insanity and things like that. That's the derivation of the word, but we don't think of it as an insanity now. Although it's interesting that the doctors who diagnosed the first dementias, particularly Alzheimer's, were psychiatrists. Alzheimer was a psychiatrist. He was also a pathologist. He found out that it was secondary to a brain disease, if you will. It was also the thought at the time, in the 19th century, that what we now call schizophrenia was a brain disease. And now we're coming back to that and saying it probably is, and we're going to be able to find actual parts of the brain that are affected in schizophrenia. So that's one of the things that we've noted, that there are people that have looked at what's happening and what's in the brain, and they've come up with four or five different forms of dementia. One is Alzheimer's, another one is called Lewy body dementia, which was what the actor Robin Williams had. And then we have frontal temporal dementia, which is also something that Willis, the actor, has. There's also vascular dementia, and there's one secondary to slow viruses, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, it's called.
And the lifestyle ways, as you describe them, that you go through in the book, that I know people are hugely keen to hear and always are and will be, are they relevant to all the different forms?
I think they are, but they're most relevant to the Alzheimer, because the Alzheimer's is usually most affected memory. It's what we call the hippocampus, which is the part of the brain where the initial information comes in from which we form a memory. And then we store that memory up in the cortex so that it's... Now, the other ones that I mentioned, the frontal temporal and Lewy body, they're often behavioral. The person begins to act strangely or irritable and anger, aggression, and things like this. These things, I don't know that they're as applicable as Alzheimer's. Like, I'd go over a couple of things that I think that are good in terms of social factors.
Yes, I mean, you take us through a number of suggestions, but we should start really with exercising memory, because that is runs throughout the book. It's not just in the lifestyle chapters, the importance of exercising memory and how and why this can help. I mean, you talk, which amazes me because it feels very simple, but you talk about the fact that word puzzles, you describe them as an antidote to dementia. Perhaps you could explain what and how that works.
Well, memory is actually the most important factor to avoid any kind of dementia. And the secrets of it are reducing non-visual things to visual. In other words, we had to learn to read, but no one had to teach us to see things. So convert materials that are words into pictures. That's really what the basis of learning and all memory systems are based on. And the most important part of memory is what we call the working memory. And I was driving to work the other day, and the radio wasn't working, so I wasn't able to listen to any talk shows or anything. So I just went through a working memory exercise. And working memory is when you maintain something in your mind but move it around, okay? So I went ahead and I did all the presidents from Eisenhower, which was way back in the 50s, up to Biden here, and I got them straight, and then I put them in alphabetical order. This is all without any pen or paper. I mean, it's very easy to do. I mean, you know, just go ahead with Biden, Bush, Carter, Clinton, Eisenhower. Of course, we missed Obama in there. Well, he's coming along next. And then you go on and get Obama in the situation in between before you get to Trump or Reagan. So Reagan, and the last one, of course, is Trump. So you have to see that in your mind as you move it around. So it's like moving.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Marquee TV. Marquee TV is an incredible streaming service that is a gateway to arts and culture. With my subscription, I've enjoyed watching some of the Royal Shakespeare Company's most acclaimed productions of recent years, including David Tennant in Richard II and Simon Russell Beale in The Tempest. I've seen multiple productions of The Ring Cycle and Thelonious Monk playing in Brussels in 1963. I've watched Alice in Wonderland at the Royal Opera House and Giselle at La Scala. Marquee TV really is the most accessible way into culture I've ever encountered, and a treasure trove for any arts lover. You can try it for 3 months for just 99p. Yep, 3 months for 99p. With the code HOWTO, just visit marquee.tv and use the promo code HOWTO to dive into the world of the arts like never before.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
I mean, you're talking to us from Washington. I mean, and also everyone can relate to US presidents, of course, but what other sorts of word puzzles, mind exercises are you talking about? Or can they, I mean, you talk about a few in the book. What other sorts of things can people do to exercise, to stretch their working memory?
Well, I think let's take a soccer team, or let's take your favorite movie and who are the actors in it, and put them in the line, and then move them around according to alphabetical order, and then line them up according to syllables, 1, 2, and 3 syllable names. All these things are mental. You do them in your mind, so that there's tokens that are being moved around in your mind. And it's very, very good. It's probably the best thing you can do to maintain your mental sharpness is to enhance your working memory. As a matter of fact, the greater the working memory, this is as children, the more intelligent the child. So a substitute for doing an IQ test is to play a game, a mental game with a child. And the greater the working memory of the child, the more intelligent the child is, and the more intelligent the child will be as it grows up. So you can also work at the other end. You get to be an adult. You can maintain these exercises for the working memory.
What other types of memory should we be aware of in order to exercise them as well?
Right. Of course, you have the memory, which is episodic memory, which is simply remembering facts, remembering things. You know, if you go over a war, for instance, you want to know the War of 1812 or something like that, with the generals, the battles, if you're interested in that. And then you can then switch it to a working memory thing by taking those data that you've learned and mixing them around.
You talk also, when you describe memory exercises, about the unbelievable importance of certain things. One is curiosity. It feels like that's the number one thing to maintain, or in fact, a lack of curiosity is a sort of signifier of dementia. But tell us about that and how you ensure you maintain a curiosity as you age.
Well, you know, about 20 years ago, I went and did a study on my own about creative people who remain creative in their 80s and 90s. So they were still creative. There was the comedian here in USA, Art Buchwald, and there were others who were famous, historian, and author, Mr. Durr. And I asked them, I interviewed them all, about what they put down as the most interesting and most important things to maintain their creativity, which was another way of saying their brain function. And curiosity was way high up on the thing. You have to be curious about people. The day I did the interview with Art Buchwald in Martha's Vineyard, he had been walking home because I was going to meet him at his home. And he saw a car accident, not a serious one, just a what we call, you know, a bumper over here. And he was waited because he wanted to see, you know, who were these people, where were they going? And he was watching all this. As he said, if you lose this curiosity, you lose your ability to function. So that's one of them good. And it's tied up with energy. In other words, try to maintain a high energy level and then maintain education, but not meaning going to school, but learning new things. That comes from the curiosity.
Yes, and you talk about, very interestingly, the importance of maintaining an autobiographical memory, going back through your life and perhaps talking to people who you knew at different times in your life.
Yes. For instance, you can augment your memory by asking other people to give their views of what happened at this particular event, particularly experiences that you've shared with a sibling, for instance. You'll often find that your memory is not as clear as it was. They're right about something and you have it wrong, even though you're totally convinced of it. So memory is a tricky thing. It's reconstructed chemically. Every time we bring back a memory and think about it, and then as we begin to think of something else, that whole memory is reconstituted chemically within the brain. So it could be a very slight variation from the original experience.
And nostalgia too, I found really interesting. How the sort of sense of nostalgia is something that's useful, sort of conjuring up that sense of nostalgia is an exercise that can help.
Yes, it can, because it causes you to once again feel expressions, emotions, continuity. Of course, one of the other things that the geniuses told me about was the need to maintain a sense of personal continuity so that you don't feel like a stranger to yourself. And one of those is the autobiographical memory that you mentioned. Very important.
Fascinating. It's all absolutely fascinating. And so is the lifestyle ways, as you describe them, away from memory. We read a lot about the sorts of things that we should be doing, but you really give us the science and the proof and talk in detail about each one. I'm sure that many people will wonder if there's truth in the commonly spoken notion that exercise, fitness, helps. And you go into this, and perhaps you could explain why it helps, how it helps, but most specifically, the balance between the types of exercise that are best to focus on for memory, for preventing dementia.
Well, first of all, we talk about exercises, either aerobic or anaerobic, which is another way of saying something that's carried out over a long period of time, such as running a marathon or something like that. And then you have other things that are shorter period where you're burning muscle, such as lifting weights and things like that. So I've mentioned in the book that you want to take up an exercise that's of interest to you, something that you enjoy doing. Otherwise, it just becomes another chore. And I also found a little secret thing that not many people are aware of, that mental exercise is actually causes you to lose weight. It's every bit as effective as physical exercise, but that's very intense kind of. For instance, during the 1984 chess championship between Kasparov and Karpov, Karpov lost about 25 pounds. In fact, they called him the match before it was completed. They stopped it because they said they were afraid he was losing too much weight. So it's been, since then, it's been shown that when you look at competition chess players, that over the space of a day, or at least the weekend of the match, they lose as much weight as somebody running a marathon. So it's no need to actually distinguish the physical from the mental in that case.
Yes, really interesting. You say that as someone like you who doesn't perhaps immediately adore the exercise notion, it's consoling to know that sort of mental exercise is also good. But presumably you have to, or presumably the sort of walking light exercise is certainly better than nothing.
Yes, of course. And I think exercise is important, but you pick what you like to do, because that way you'll do it. So it just doesn't become another chore every day. If you don't like running, then don't do it. Maybe you enjoy swimming, join a swim club. It's important that you do the exercise, but you do something that's going to be a pleasure, or at least something you're willing to go to every day. And that's, I think, a little bit here in the U.S., whether it's the Puritanism or what, people forcing themselves into exercises that they don't really enjoy.
You go into actually some serious detail, which I think people will really appreciate reading when they come to it, about diet. We won't go into all of it because you illustrate the sorts of vitamins that are good. You illustrate really you talk a great deal about it. But what would be your takeaway bit of advice when it comes to diet? Is there one specific diet that people should follow, or is it more about what you avoid eating other than anything else, i.e. ultra processed foods?
Yes, you've summed it up perfectly. I think it's a matter of not so much that any particular diet is going to make us necessarily more healthy, but if you eat ultra processed food, now I want to make clear about that. I mean, you know, processed foods are fine. I mean, if you didn't have processing, you wouldn't have the modern food industry. Certain foods have to be boiled and things like that. And you pasteurization, that's all good. But when you get to ultra processing, you're adding things in there for the purpose of preserving the food with false, with artificial flavorings rather than natural things. That's not good for you. And to have a diet on the basis of ultra processed food is not good at all. Now, think about diet as one part of a jigsaw puzzle. I mean, it's important that you have a good diet, but it's just one part. There's no magic diet. Even the Mediterranean diet that we all recommend, and I recommend in my book, there's at least one study out showing that was not effective. Now, some people say that Malmo study was done was an outlier, that it was not going to be seen again, and that's possible. But on the other hand, I think it's a good point to take that you can't just emphasize one thing. You've got about 8 or 10 different things that you try to bring into cohesion and use them all, not just one, but all of them. And the more you use, and the better you are at them, then the better your longevity. One of the things I mentioned in the book is about the great obsession, where people become interested in something and they devote their lives to it and their free time to it. There's an article in the Washington Post just this week about a man who about 30 years ago decided he wanted to build a perfect Wi-Fi system, hi-fi, a sound system. And it's all the work that he went into that and all the time he put in on it. And it enabled him to live into his 80s, and they could certainly help them because this was something he was like obsessed about. And I tell people who become obsessed with something, I call it the grand obsession.
Are you saying that's a good thing?
I think it's a good thing. Yeah. As long as you put it in the context of your family and things like that, there's a little bit of, it's worth reading this article. I mean, he got into conflict with his family because he was becoming a little too devoted to this. So he took it a little too far. But at the end of his life, he started to say, I wish I'd just, not been quite as aggressive about this as I was.
Yeah, really interesting. I suppose it's a bit like a flow state sort of a scenario, being obsessed with something. It's a focus that is good for your mind.
It is, because it makes you want, every morning you wake up and you want to get to it. You get a little bit like that when you're writing a book, actually. You want to think, what are we going to write about today? What is it I want to do? I imagine novelists must have a lot of fun doing that. Never written a novel. I'd like to. Maybe I will.
Yes, well, that could be your next project. And that's really interesting. I didn't read that necessarily within the pages, but having a project or an obsession, something that you really, really focus on, can be very, very useful, as long as you don't, you know, alienate everybody around you. And perhaps the talking of alienating everybody around you, it's another hugely important lifestyle choice, or not a choice for some people, but essential, is not alienating people around you. So when I say that, I mean socializing, not being on your own and surrounding yourself with people, making a concerted effort to do that, even if it's not something that comes to you naturally, feels like it's something that you are very much advocating if you want to ward off and do your best to ward off dementia.
Yes, and I think you can combine things. Like, for instance, there are just some people that are kind of loners. And to say to them, well, you have to be more social and get to meet more people and all that, that doesn't get them activated. You say something like, well, what are some of your interests? Oh, well, I have an interest in pens, for instance, a patient of mine. And I said, well, have you looked up if there are any pen clubs? So he did. There were pen clubs here in Washington. So he joined one of them. And he started, he now looks forward to it. He goes to it all the time. Same thing with cooking clubs and dinner clubs, where people get together once a month and one of them cooks the dinner, or everybody brings something, or they go out to a gourmet restaurant. It's not just so much that you're getting together with people, but you're getting together about a common subject which draws you together. As I said in my book, it can breed a new friendship or even a romance. Who knows what will come of it?
Yeah. So sort of book clubs, sports clubs, those sorts of things.
Yes.
You combining both friendship and relationships with whatever, it's something that's maybe cognitive, something that's maybe physical. Again, really, really interesting.
Hey there. I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I mean, you talk about, I want to move on to audience questions quite quickly today, because there are so many, and I knew that people would have lots of questions on this subject. But you talk about, we've been through fitness, we talked about diet, socializing, you talk about sleep, you talk about coffee, you talk about alcohol, various other things. Would you say there's one thing that's most important or not?
Well, I think we've talked about the memory. I think that the working memory, if you didn't do anything else except keep working on your working memory and do the socialization through things that get you together with people with a common interest, then you pick up your curiosity, your intellectual rigor, your excitement, all this together. So that's what I think are the most important things.
Yes, you say, you've reminded me that reading is one of the combinations. You talked about writing a novel, reading for pleasure, really combines so many of the parts of your advice, or so many of the advisable things to do. Why is that?
Well, reading a novel requires a particular set of mind. I mean, you've got to be able to follow the characters throughout the book. You'll get somebody that's introduced early in the book, and you don't read about them for another 100 pages. You have to sort of keep in mind, so you have like a past, present, and look to the future and link them together. So that's really the kind of thing that you see with a novel, which you don't see it so much with nonfiction books. Like my book, I particularly wrote it as a way that people could, if they wished, read it in various ways according to their interests. Chapter sounds like it might be more interesting than another to them, they can read it. But it'd be hard to do that with a novel, pick it up in the middle and start reading and not knowing what came before.
We've got so many questions. I'm going to move on to them to get through them because they're all very brilliant questions, as they always are from our How To Academy audience. So this is a very specific question from Tamara, which is what you think of, and I'm afraid I don't know it, so you might have to let us know if you do, the AHEAD study and lecanemab for people with increased risk of Alzheimer's disease.
I'm not sure what they're referring to. They'd have to be a little more specific. The AHEAD study?
We'll ask Tamara to clarify, and then we can come back to that. Somebody says that they read a book recently that claimed dementia was a result of a lack of certain vitamins and minerals, and that can be diagnosed through blood tests. Is that the case?
Well, it could be. We've gotten to the point that Alzheimer's will be able to be diagnosed with blood tests. In fact, it already can be to a certain extent, which is another area we could talk about with pleasure in terms of what the implications there are of that, whether people really want to get that information. But vitamins and minerals and things like that no doubt play a role, but there's never been any proof that they are the underlying cause of it. Now, there are causes, there are cases of dementia that are reversible if you have the loss of like a vitamin B12 or something like that, but they're very rare. They're not really rare, what we're talking about here.
I mean, Robin has now said this as well. Are there tests that you can take to see if you're prone to this disease? And as you say, you talk about this in the book, and you also talk about the sort of reasons why you might not want to know. I think some of us would relate to that. But then the reasons why it might become absolutely necessary to both yourself and people around you that you do.
Right. Yeah. This is because of the obligations that you have to other people, states, final wishes, things like that, so that it's something you probably should know, particularly if it runs in the family, so to speak. If it's been your grandmother had it, your mother had it, then it would be probably worthwhile testing, because perhaps you'd come to the conclusion you're not going to marry, or if you marry, you're not going to have children.
If an older person already has dementia with memory issues and strange behaviors, is there anything that can be done to stop it or slow down?
Well, one of the things is the attitude we take towards how you interact with them. I mentioned towards the end of the book these Alzheimer villages where you get people together who have this impairment and they're able to get along with themselves without being in a custodial type of situation. See, the problem is too much, running to say this is like cancer, can't be cured, it's going to get worse and all that. Well, it does sometimes, many times, but there are cases that it kind of levels off. There are cases in which are milder than others. I still have patients that continue to be employed who have mild Alzheimer's.
But in terms of slow, so that, I mean, the Anthony was asking in terms of sort of slowing it down, is the advice that you give, I think Anthony is saying, is it relevant if you already have dementia? Can you slow the process down?
To a certain extent, if you have the correct interactions and you're up to the minute on how to manage certain situations, which can be taught, by the way. People don't have to be nurses or doctors. You don't argue with someone who's got a delusion or some ideas that are not right. Just change the subject. Little things like that enable them to stay longer in their home. And that, of course, is the goal, because particularly if you look back, this is something that the person would have wanted. They would have wanted to stay in their home. But if they become so difficult that they can't be managed, then, of course, it's hard to do that.
Yes, that's really important. I remember this from a previous book and How To Academy interview. Don't argue with someone who has dementia. You should stay with them in the world that they're in, not to confuse or upset them.
Yeah, I try to not confuse or upset them, but don't necessarily agree to the content of the hallucination or delusion or something, because then they begin to realize that not only are they having problems, but you're going right along with it.
Now, I think this is a really important question from someone anonymous, which you talk about in the book and we haven't talked about. We all start forgetting things, they say, but what are the clear signs, the warning signs?
I give the example of somebody going into, a shopping center to buy something because they have a sale, and you drive there, get out of your car and run in and buy what you want and spend a little more time in there. And then you come out and you can't find out where you parked. And people say, oh, that must be the sign of dementia. I must be getting dementia. It's not. You were distracted. You went in there with a particular goal to get this particular item. And then you weren't particularly paying attention to where you parked. Now, if you came out of the store and you couldn't remember how you got to the shopping center, whether you took the bus or whether someone drove you, that would be a little more worrisome. So it's a matter of forgetting, which has more serious implications, deeper layers of forgetting. Don't know how I got here. Well, that would be abnormal and unusual.
So some people have come with the same question, which actually, funnily enough, I was thinking myself. Do you get the same benefit, they're asking, from listening to audiobooks as from reading books, or is it the reading process that you need to do?
Well, that depends. You know, most people have either an auditory memory, an auditory cognition, or a perceptual visual. And you can go back to school when you were in college. Did you like to hear the lectures? Is that how you learned? Or did you want to just read somebody's notes later? That's actually the very frequent reason where people don't go to classes. They don't get that much out of hearing it, but they would like to read their friend's notes because then they can get it in that way. So I tend to do both of them. Whenever I use an audiobook, I tend to read the book at the same time. I do it for two reasons, one of which, as a writer, it gives me a sense of how the structure of the book is, how sentences and paragraphs are structured, which is of great interest to me. And secondly, it slows you down to the pace that the author intended you to read it. You're not reading too fast or too slow. So it's not either or audio or read books. You can do both.
So this is you're talking about audio, and something you talk about in the book is hearing loss. And Jackie says, I have a client with hearing loss. During our conversation, a certain topic was stated over and over as if for the first time. Is this a sign of dementia?
Well, the single most important thing to prevent dementia is to have your hearing checked. Because worldwide, it's the number one cause of dementia. In other words, it's the number one background fact that you can say this person is deaf. Because if you don't hear what's being said, you can't follow arguments, you can't discuss dialogue with people. And then if you mishear, so that you hear something that really wasn't said, I give the example of three people talking about their favorite pet. And one of them said, well, I like dogs because I used to go hunting with my father. We had dogs, so I like dogs. And the second one said, well, my mother always kept cats, so I like cats. And the other one said, I like vicious pets. So, you know, everybody else said vicious pets. And he said, well, I didn't say vicious pets. I said fish as pets. So there was this hearing problem, which would have led to misunderstanding of the mentality or the intention of the speaker. So that would send everybody along a different trail to follow because they heard it wrong. So the most important thing, anybody, if you're over 50 years of age, you should have your hearing checked. Make sure it's good because you may need hearing aids.
Really interesting. We talked about nostalgia in our discussion, and one of our audience members was wondering specifically how you can use nostalgia, like how it works to increase your memory as an exercise. How do you use it?
I think one of the ways you could, like going through a book of pictures of the family, different events, Christmas, and look at it, and who can remember the most about it, or what can you remember about it? Do you remember what you got for Christmas? What people gave you? What was the weather like? Where did you eat dinner? Did you go out, or did you sit at the house? You might not be able to do all of that, but you could come up with more, and more of it's important. Who wasn't there? Who you know, that type of thing. That's nostalgia, and it'll give you, emotional responses. That's very important, by the way, to do things that do cause the arousal of normal positive emotions, because that's also helpful to keeping you from getting dementia.
You remind me or make me think that really storytelling, sort of collective storytelling, which is something so innate in humans, is clearly something that can be very helpful, sort of something, again, that you do with other people. I think this is a really important question. I'm sure others feel this themselves or have relatives struggling, but how can I best support my mum, somebody asks, who is showing increasing signs of memory loss? She is terrified it is dementia because both her dad and her aunt had it. She is 82 and a retired mental health nurse. I mean, I think it begs the question, you know, that you talk about a lot, about the sort of trying not to be terrified of these things, because that is a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy or a vicious circle, as you describe it.
Yeah, and that's a worrisome situation, I admit. From Lisa, the questioner, I think that's all you can do is try to calm her down, and it may need medication in some cases, because one of the cruelties of dementia is that people do sometimes have insight into it, but can't explain it otherwise. They just know there's something wrong with their thinking.
Yeah. Okay, this is a very specific question to diet, but it is something you talk about, ketones, and I think others might know. David says, "Dear Dr. Restak, I've recently become aware of ketones and the beneficial role they may play in cognition, dementia mitigation, and was wondering if coconut oil, which has ketones, is also beneficial, or is it specifically the microchain triglycerides within coconut oil that are beneficial, and would you recommend taking it?" Very specific question to coconut oil, but you do talk about the keto diet. People might be wondering, is that the diet? You said earlier there isn't a specific one, but does that lend itself better than others?
Well, ketones are the result of the fasting. So if someone goes on fasting, they will develop ketones within 24 to 48 hours. And one of the interesting things about ketones is that it gives you a little bit of a euphoria. So the people often feel quite good when they're metabolizing fats, which is what produces the ketone, rather than metabolizing carbohydrates. So you have to say, well, maybe they're not doing as well as they think they are, but of course, maybe they are. Fasting is an approach that's been proven to be effective in animals, particularly in laboratory animals, that they live longer, that they have better memories and all this for like running through mazes. There is some suggestive evidence that intermittent fasting is good for you, yes. So that could do. Now, I'm not sure of anything about coconut oil. I haven't heard any studies that indicated that was by itself a benefit.
What advice if you live alone and immediate family have died or live far away? Is it better to interact with people you've known for many years or meet new people even later in life? I imagine a balance is probably better.
Well, that's linked to one of the things I do write about in the book, is to try to link with younger people. There's an advantage to that. So that if you're, let's say, 70 years of age, it's nice to get along and see people of the same age, but it's nice to have a friend that may be 40 or 45. My mother was like that. She lived to be 95, but she always had younger women that she knew, because she said it kept her up to date on what everybody was doing and thinking about and what the latest song was and so forth. So that's, I think, beneficial, that you link with people that are younger. Now, in terms of people that you've known a long time, it's always just good to get new friends, but you certainly want to keep the ones you've had.
I think this is a really interesting question. I heard about a case where a GP had an elderly gentleman who had a diagnosis of dementia and was on a large number of prescription drugs, as I'm sure many elderly people are, and often too many. The GP reduced the medications over time and the dementia symptoms disappeared. Is it possible, this audience member asks, that over-medication can cause dementia or dementia-like symptoms?
The answer is yes, and you have to distinguish between delirium. Delirium is a short, is a curable, reversible dementia, if you will, and you can get it from medicines. In fact, that's the frequent cause of it. So it's not really a dementia. You just say they acted like they had dementia. But if someone's taking the drug day after day after day and they're acting like they're demented, then you could say, yeah, they've got dementia secondary to this drug. Let's try stopping the drug and see what happens. And many times we see, like this person describes, they get better.
So another question is really interesting. I've heard of music and opera for people with already diagnosed and sufferers, and how useful that is in terms of just what you were talking about, emotional stimulation and taking them back to certain memories. But Amrit asks whether listening to music can help ward off dementia.
Yes, it can. It also will ward off depression. So the music, of course, is associated with all kinds of things, like when was it written, who wrote it, what was the word, where do they live, all the various things, then plus the stuff that's intrinsic to the music. And if you're a musician, or at least you know how to play an instrument or read music, it's further enriching.
How does that work? Or what's the best way of using music? Is it just listening to music? Is it using it with some sort of memory exercise, as you suggested earlier?
No, you can sometimes just listen to music because you like it. If you like Ravel, then you can listen to Ravel. You may not necessarily be a musician, but I find that his music very pleasing. I find it relaxing too. So, and I'm not a musician.
Tamara replied to her question that we were asking for clarification. I'm sorry if I pronounce it wrong. Lecanemab is a drug to clear amyloid from the brains of people who have too much amyloid in them. And she was wondering what you make of that.
Well, that, of course, has been the basis for all of the drug trials that have come out over the last 20 years. There have been drugs that successfully cleared amyloid from animal models. And they did seem to indicate that the animal model then did better in terms of running through mazes and all that. Now, recently, in the humans, it didn't seem to do anything. The amyloid would decrease. It would decrease, but there wouldn't be any reversal of the clinical picture. So this latest drugs are such that they claim that there is the elution or the elimination or the decrease of the amyloid. And in addition, there's clinical improvement. So that's great. But as I said earlier, there's a lot of side effects with these drugs, and you have to be careful. And there's not that much of improvement, by the way. There's been, you know, yes, they've shown some improvement, but it's not great.
Another really interesting question. You talk about this in the book. Jules asks, is there a link between depression and dementia? Depression and dementia.
Yes. If depression will lead to dementia, secondary, a person who has dementia can, as a result, become depressed, like the person who asked the question about her mother. She's obviously becoming anxious. She can also become depressed. Sometimes depression will present in a way that appears to be dementia. So that you say, this person's demented. But if you try them on an antidepressant, you find out that the dementia goes away. So they actually were demented. They were depressed, not demented. And that's more common than you think.
I mean, this comes down to this question of how difficult this is to diagnose. And I expect misdiagnosis often happens. Angie says something which I know is a problem, that she's witnessed both elderly and not so elderly people diagnosed with dementia when they had, in fact, serious urinary tract infections, which can cause confusion and prove fatal without medication. There are many things. You mentioned depression. She mentions UTIs. There are many things that it could be, and we perhaps have a tendency to jump to the conclusion that it's dementia.
I couldn't agree with that more. Absolutely. There are curable ways. They all should be eliminated before anyone says that an individual has, because dementia really is irreversible brain damage, and it's progressive. So before you reach that dire conclusion, you want to make sure that they're not suffering from something that's reversible and is not necessarily progressive.
What do you think society can do more widely to help?
Well, I think one of the things would be to change some of the views we see on TV and on movies. All the movies that have come out in the last decades have shown advanced cases of Alzheimer's. Very rarely do you see anything with a mild case. So that's one thing. And of course, that has effect on people's attitude of how they treat and react and respond to and interact with people with dementia, early dementia. There are cases of early dementia that don't necessarily progress at a rapid rate.
Any other ways in which we as people who aren't directly related should look to sort of improving the ways we talk about it, the ways we react to it, the messages that we send out?
Well, I think on the basis of what we're doing today, really this evening, is to let people more aware of it. It gets back to the first questions you asked about what are the three characteristics, and one of which is to realize that it's part of a continuum. And, you know, it's something that somebody may be at a certain level on this movement towards advanced dementia. And of course, they may wind up with mild cognitive impairment, which we haven't talked about, in which actually you have your performance isn't quite normal, but you're able to do most of the things that you have to do in your role in life.
And I mean, people will wonder in terms of how often or when dementia does lead to death. It doesn't necessarily.
Yeah, well, dementia is a fatal illness. I mean, if it becomes serious enough, usual death is from like pneumonia or things like that, because they just lose the ability to self-activate, self-actualize. And that's why physical therapy is very important sometimes, to keep people moving along and treat the depression that's there, as I said, because you may well see improvement if you treat depression.
Well, let's end with whether laughter helps people with dementia, or indeed warding off dementia. I have read a great deal about the benefits of laughter.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Sense of humor. It's putting things in context and changing the context. It's humorous to do that. That's the basis of most humors. So, yeah, that's very important, because people sometimes with moderately advanced dementia, they will respond to comedy and to jokes, things like that. It's also a test that you can find out if they understand, because every piece of comedy worthwhile involves some abstraction ability, some ability to compare one situation with another. That's what makes it funny.
Well, it has been such so fascinating, as I said it would be, talking to you. And it's been also wonderful to have so much interaction from an audience. Such an important subject, so much fascination. Alison, thank you for your comment. That's Hannah McInnes and Dr. Richard Restak. And Alison says she's off to buy your book, Dr. Restak, and I'm sure many others will be too. So thank you very, very much for joining
thank
us.
Thank you. Wonderful to be on. It's good to see you again.
Thank you.
This episode of the podcast starred Dr. Richard Restak and was presented by Hannah McInnes. The show is produced by me and Nicole Wong, and our editor is John Doughty. Until next time, I'm Vass Christodoulou. Thanks for listening.